Thank you very much, Emanuele. You may sit down here.
Thank you.
Now we have a little bit of a discussion. We make it the following way. I'm going to ask a few questions, and then it's your turn, and you can ask some questions to Mr. Ottolenghi. The microphone will be yours if you come up and ask the questions. I will start with a few questions myself. The first one is, when you show up with that detailed information about the fake companies of Iran at the US government, what are the reactions when you come up with all the data? So how they change names, how they make their finances channel to different difficult ways. So is there a positive reaction with the US Treasury? Because as we've got some experiences ourselves with the German government, which sometimes is very reluctant when you bring them some information about these things. Can you take that one?
Yeah.
Turn on, please.
Thank you. Well, my experience is, without exception, that whenever you go to government officials and offer them information, they say thank you and please, you know, pass it along. The real question is what they do with it afterwards, and I actually have no insight. Sometimes I, you know, highlight certain things, and 6 months later I find them in a press release by this or that government agency. Sometimes I pass it on and nothing happens. So I don't know. What I can tell you is that I think, and that's true for any government, is that if they get information from any source, no matter how detailed or accurate or well documented it is, governments have an obligation to go and verify themselves, and they have their own methodology. They have different sources also, which we have no access to. You know, we rely only on things we find in the public domain. You know, whenever people say, how do you find all these things? What's your secret weapon? The answer is Google. Okay. And they have access to other sources, other databases, which you cannot verify or read into. So I suspect that that's what they do. They get the information, and if there is a political will to pursue it, they do their own verifications, and in the fullness of time, hopefully, that yields results. But I can't comment on either how they do it or the political will that drives them.
So I suppose there are some governments who are more reluctant than others. The other things, I know that you made a lot of investigations concerning German companies in the Düsseldorf area, and surely about the number of ports, and I would like you to report a little bit on that, the specific findings of...
Let me tell you, I can't comment on Hamburg, but I am happy to talk about Düsseldorf, or more accurately, Dinslaken. So last year I found that a factory in Dinslaken was owned by a company and was run by managers entirely of Iranian background. And again, that in and of itself proves nothing, but all of these people at some point or another had worked for Iranian government subsidiaries in London, in Dusseldorf, and in other parts. And one of them actually in the 1990s had been a senior board member of Iran Khodro, the biggest Iranian car maker. Now, Iran Khodro was mentioned in the German press, I think in January of 2013. As allegedly being a conduit for dual use technology, and the automotive industry you know, relies on a lot of either technology or raw materials that are dual use, and also the machinery used in the production. production of cars and car parts can be dual use. So the factory was interesting, and I first tried to figure out who owned the factory, and long story short, the factory was in the ownership of, handed in the ownership of an Iranian religious foundation run by then, by an Ayatollah who was the former Minister of Intelligence. And then it had gone through a bankruptcy procedure and had been rescued financially and salvaged financially in 2011 and taken over by a company that could be traced back to the financial empire of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Mr. Khamenei himself. So that kind of raised some eyebrows. Having done all of this research through internet sources, commercial documents from the registry, and so on, I thought that it was worth making a trip, and coming to talk to people. I wanted to talk to the local authorities, I wanted to talk to the Chamber of Commerce, I wanted to talk to the, what is it called, the export controls, the
Chamber of Commerce.
The internal secret service. I reached out to the customs authorities. Nobody wanted to see me. Nobody had time. I'm sorry for my town. I'm sorry we're closed that week. I'm sorry on holiday. I'm sorry I'm sick that week. Nobody could see me. Okay. So anyway, I'm searching and searching and searching, and all of a sudden I stumble upon a German language publication, which, you know, thanks to my 5 years of non-existent German, I could understand, was the publication of the what is it called, IG Metall,
the trade union,
for metals, and he talked about a strike at the factory against the Iranian owners. And he named the specific union, local union trade union leader who had been in charge of the demonstration. They were complaining about salaries. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to send an email to this person and see if he's still there. So he emails me back saying, I'm no longer in charge, this is the person in charge. You can contact him, I'm going to send an email to this person. I get an email response. I would love to see you. When are you coming? Please call me. So I go to Dusseldorf and I ring him up and I say, I'm here. He says, I'm so delighted you called me. You know, by the way, that the factory is closing down in 3 weeks. The ownership is liquidating it. They're laying off 125 people. And this factory is not a metropolis. 125 people lose their job. The whole factory closes down. It means hundreds of other jobs on the line for all the services, you know, from the sandwich shop, laundry, whoever. So it's a big hit for the town. Everybody's concerned. So I go to his office, we have a long meeting, I show him the whole corporate map, telling him who owns it. And he says, you want to talk to the workers? I said, of course I want to talk to the workers. Nobody else wants to talk to me. So he gets me to the factory. And the workers show me around, and at some point they show me a machine and say, you know what that machine is? I said, oh, I don't know, I have no qualification except for finding things I shouldn't know about. So they said, look, that machine is called a flow forming machine.
What?
A flow forming machine. And it's a machine that the factory produced cylinders. From the cylinders the scuba diver uses for oxygen to go scuba diving, to cylinders that contain compressed natural gas for hybrid cars, and bigger cylinders that could be used, that were being used by the Indian aerospace industry to fuel rockets, right? For rocket fuel. So again, you see it has dual use. And what are the cylinders made of? They're made of carbon fiber and reinforced steel. Steel, special quality of steel, interesting. carbon fiber. You have carbon fiber at the factory. Yes, we have a ton of carbon fiber, this, this, that. Okay. And I said, can you use the machine for anything else? He said, yeah. You can use it to build anything around. So I called a colleague who is in Washington, who's an expert in nuclear technology, and I said, what would you do with this machine? And he says, centrifuges. Okay. So the regime had bought a factory and had tried to actually export the machine. First they had bought the machine from the factory and tried to export it. But the factory had been caught in the hostile takeover of their previous owners, which was a big German industry, Salzgitter. So that blocked the transfer of the machine, and then BAFA was alerted, they became aware of it, and BAFA intervened and blocked the transfer of the machine. So the Iranian said that the factory is
BAFA is the German export control system, but
so the Iranian said, if we can't get the machine, we're going to buy the factory. And they bought it. And then they started sending delegations of engineers. Over the ten following years, they sent delegations of engineers who periodically would come to the factory and spend a few weeks at the factory. And in 2011, when the factory again went through a bankruptcy procedure, all of a sudden, it turns out the Iranian holding company that owns the factory in Germany, which was called MCS International by then, opens up a new company in Iran called Pars MCS, which produces cylinders. And until they took the website down in April 2013, you could see the photographs of the factory, and it looked exactly the same, down to the lighting, to the factory in Islam. So long story short, that was a classic example of how the regime manages to circumvent sanctions. They couldn't buy the technology, so they bought the factory, and then they sent people to acquaint themselves with the technology. And slowly and patiently, they bought the technology they needed piece by piece and reassembled the entire factory back home. And 125 German workers lost their jobs and the livelihood that they had, and their families have suffered. And, you know, and again, you know, one of the things that the workers kept telling me was, all these years, these Iranian owners would not invest anything in modernizing the factory, in making it profitable, because they were interested in the profit. They were interested in the technology they could extract from the factory, from the workers' knowledge and their experience, so that they could rebuild it back at home and use it.
And Dr. Otolenghi gave this information to a TV team of ARD, and a film was made, a 50 minutes film. If you want to see it, go on YouTube on the Stop the Bomb channel. I have the honor to be interviewed too, and Otolenghi produced the film, and I might say the right information that he delivered. So I might open the floor to your questions. Please step up to the microphone and ask your question. That is no question. That
Sorry,
is
just a party. Thank you very much.
Enjoy your evening and thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. So this character, when you were telling, they were copying that factory. They were not dismantling it and taking it by
force. They could not export the technology.
So the old structure is still standing there in this time.
So. The factory was liquidated and was closed on the 31st of March 2013. And then the owner of the factory, who at the time was denying any linkage to the Iranian regime, had appointed himself liquidator and was trying to sell the technology to recoup financial losses. And I gave the story to a journalist. The Washington Post, who wrote the story, and he came to Germany and interviewed him, and he said at the time that he was trying to sell it to India. Now, hopefully, after the story was published in the Washington Post and the art documentary, and you know, eventually I did manage to pass this information. Sorry, I did manage to pass this information to authorities here. Hopefully, the export control agency made sure that this machine would not be sold to anyone, because, of course, you know, again, India would be a place where if you can set up a front company, which Iranians are doing in India, you can sell the machinery there, then you know, any hope that the end user license will be respected are delusional.
Yeah. There was one question here.
Okay.
Speak up a little bit.
Yeah, okay. Can you tell us a little bit about how big the network is outside Iran, with the network of front companies and how many people are involved? I mean, some kind of, like, you get an idea, and who is organizing it inside Iran? I mean, is there anybody who is in contact with everybody, organizes what kind of deals they are doing? What goods are delivered, and who is that inside
the market? So, thank you for your question. So, the question is how many companies and people are involved in these networks, and who's organizing it? So, quantifying is very difficult. You know, I take on average anywhere between 2 to 6 months to map out the entire network. And typically a network would be about 20, 30 companies, sometimes more, sometimes a little less. And the ones I find, there are things that I can't find. I mean, you know, I read several languages, but in this job you have to get into, you know, I have to get into the Georgian commercial registry, fully searchable, very friendly, except you need to read Georgian and type it too. So sometimes it's hard to find everything, but it's possible. So sometimes big networks, sometimes they're small. But based on what I found, I think that we're talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of companies across the world. Which means, correspondingly, hundreds, if not thousands, of people involved. Sometimes these operations are very small. So in the case of the Hamburg trial we're familiar with the sale of valves in to Iran from Iraq, the reactor through, if I remember correctly, was Turkey and Azerbaijan, the two front companies that were being used.
This for the rest of the
world. Yes, so there was a trial last year in Hamburg against three Iranian dual nationals and a German citizen. The Iranians were father and son, and I can't remember what the relation was with the third individual. And then there was a German gentleman involved. And they were caught selling dual-use technology, which was destined to the heavy water reactor in Iran.
That heavy water reactor would have produced two atomic bombs, material for two bombs a year, if it would go online. And this was part of the Geneva negotiations last November.
Correct. So, you know, very critical element of the nuclear program, very sensitive technology. Now, in this case, it was basically, as far as I can tell, I mean, the German media did not publish any names of companies or individuals. But they published enough that you could find both names and companies you wanted to. It was basically one company incorporated in Hamburg in the name of one of the two family members that was being run from their home. There was another case a couple of years ago, which was very similar, involving again a Swedish-Iranian national who was operating from his apartment in Stockholm, running one company. So the procurement was very small. But some of the other networks are huge. There are dozens of companies, and oftentimes, the bigger the most the more ex-
expansive the focus of these networks, of course, the more companies and people will be involved. So that's the first point. The second point is that who's behind it? So most of these companies are created by Iranian regime companies or Iranian or proxies of government officials. So there have been a number of Iranian entities sanctioned both by the US and the European Union linked to the Iran oil industry, to the National Iran Oil Company, that created subsidiaries, which created subsidiaries, and so on. Now, in one specific case, the company that I have in mind, which was sanctioned, was originally incorporated in Jersey Island. Jersey Island is one of the Channel Islands, so it's part of the British Isles, but it's one of those weird island British jurisdictions, so it's got its own independent charter government, but it's part of the UK at the same time, and it's offshore. So, you know, banking, there's more banking secrecy, there's more taxation, and so on. So they incorporated it in Jersey. Then the Jersey company created a subsidiary in London, which then created a subsidiary in Switzerland. When they became under pressure from the European and US authorities for their activities, they closed the company in Jersey and moved it to Labuan, Malaysia. So again, you see these places recurring. Now, in Switzerland, they eventually got sanctioned. So they created a new company with a new name. The first company was called Naftiran Intertrade Company in Switzerland. And then they created a company called PetroSuisse Intertrade. That was sanctioned. So they created another company called Pearl Energy. That was sanctioned. So they created another company called Oyster Services, I think. Sanctioned. Okay. So at that point, they stopped incorporating companies at the same address of the building owned by Naftiran Intertrade, and they just opened a new company at the house of one of the executives, which was called National West Services. Not sanctioned. They ran it for 2 or 3 years, then they closed it down. And they opened a new company, which is now active, owned by one of the former executives of the companies that I just mentioned. The company is called Villa Suisse Construction. Okay? And in the, I don't know how to say it in either English or German, the French word is raison sociale. So the purpose of it, the type of activity the company supposedly does in the commercial papers is luxury real estate. Now, I have no idea whether they've built, you know, even one garage in Switzerland or anywhere. But that's not the point. The point is that, you know, you go after a company, they close it down, they create another. And so you have that. And all of the people involved, one way or another, link back to either government banks or the oil industry. In this particular case, most of the people involved were oil company and Bank Mellat, which is the bank that has been specifically involved in transacting for the oil industry. In other cases, it's other government companies. So there is a gentleman in London, the one I mentioned who drives the Bentley. He used to work for the shipping lines, the Islamic Republic of Iran shipping lines. In Dusseldorf, you recall, there is a company that is under both European and US sanction called Ascotec. Ascotec was controlled by the Ministry of Mines. There is a company in Hamburg called Niedco, which is connected to Nisico, the National Iran Copper Industry Company, which is connected to a certain group of people in the government. And interestingly enough, there is overlapping with Mahanian. So, you know, you can trace them back to a variety of companies and sometimes factions. Now, the interesting thing is that the former director of Ascotec, who is a very close friend of mine now, he lives in the US. He doesn't work for the regime anymore, he says. I should say a close acquaintance, not a friend. He told me that at any twist and turn in the activities that he used to be involved in, they were competing with other groups. Okay, and I said, why were you competing? He said, well, you know, we were 12 and they were 18, and the contract was worth $100 million, and there was a commitment to be taken, and you know, if you divide 10 million by 12 or by 18, there is a difference. So we were trying to convince the whoever was commissioning that we would make, we should make it, because we would become richer. So there is always that component, and therefore you have a lot of different networks competing with one another. And the problem with this is that it's so hard to trace and identify, and there are so many of them that I can't quantify. But I have a fairly accurate idea of how they function. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, thank you for your question. As I said at the beginning, the sanctions are part of the diplomatic effort. And it's a fact that the regime has come to the negotiating table with a completely different attitude because the sanctions have started hurting so much. I know you're shaking your head, but I think we're going to have to agree to disagree here. Now, do sanctions enrich people who try to circumvent them? By definition, just like the harder you make it to steal the Gioconda from the Louvre, the more money will the thief make who steals the painting. Okay? The point is that sanctions have done two things. One, they have caused significant damage to the Iranian economy that the regime suddenly felt that this was a threat to its own existence and survival. And two, they have made it very difficult for the regime, even as people within the circle of power may be getting richer, has made it extremely difficult to get the kind of technology they need to advance the program. Iran is no longer able to procure the high quality maraging steel it needs to continue producing centrifuges. Iran was able to buy huge quantities of maraging steel before the sanctions regime kicked in. It can no longer get the quality it needs, and it's not at a position yet to produce the same level of quality it needs to continue to sustain the program with indigenous production. Iran cannot buy today the quality of carbon fiber it needs for its own nuclear program and missile program. It produces carbon fiber, it has initiated its own production. The quality is very low. Now, I assume, given that it is a very educated society, it's a very resourceful society, they're still sending a lot of students abroad to study hard sciences, that sooner or later they will overcome that hurdle. But the sanctions have significantly slowed down their procurement efforts. And I would posit to you that had there not been any sanctions, Iran would not have had any motivation to negotiate down its nuclear capability. It would have crossed the line already a long time ago. So I think that the sanctions have been significantly effective in achieving their goal. They have increased the leverage of the international community and have actually made diplomacy, if not successful, still a viable option. If we didn't have the sanctions, Iran would probably look like a lunar landscape today. And I don't think that either you or anyone else in this room would wish that happen.
Oh, yeah.
So my question is, who are the
So, the who is aware of these activities? You know, I assume a lot of the research I do I publish, so hopefully somebody reads it. I'm not the only one who does this research, and governments are involved in monitoring at a variety of levels, monitoring the implementation of the sanctions regime. So hopefully there are a lot of people involved, and I'm telling you a lot of stories because they're based on things that have been made public in the fullness of time. Hopefully there's a lot more going on which we're not aware of, but governments are. Now, one of the challenges, of course, is that it's much easier to break the law than actually prove that law has been broken and punishment can be meted out. You know, that challenge exists in all fields of activity. When somebody doesn't pay taxes, it takes a lot more effort and resources by the government to find the tax evader than for an individual, to cheat the system. So, part of the problem we're confronting is just like with any other type of crime, and a lot of these networks act and function like international organized crime. It is that you need sufficient evidence to actually prosecute these people. As you know, one of the problems the European Union is confronting in its sanctions regime with Iran is that a lot of the companies that the EU has targeted for sanctions are challenging those sanctions in courts of law. And the EU has lost some cases, mainly because the sanctions were based on classified evidence that cannot be shared in court. So, one of the problems that the international community, and especially the EU and the US, which are at the forefront of the sanctions regime, have, is to find enough evidence, both through intelligence gathering and open sources, to prove that these things are in fact nefarious. And so it takes a lot of time, but I can assure you that it's something that is being done at all levels by NGOs, by researchers, and by governments.
First of all, I want to add that the sanctions do work very well in the oil industry. The oil output of Iran has gone down during the last years because the modern technology needed to enhance oil recovery in old fields, the Iranians were not able to buy. And the export has gone down even to those countries where they are allowed to export. Secondly, I want to ask you this. The countries who are most insert. So I'm a little bit surprised they're telling us that it's so easy for the Iranians to start companies in Dubai. How come?
Business is business. I mean, look, it's also easy for Iran to incorporate in Turkey, and it's, by the way, it's very easy to incorporate here. In some of the companies I have been looking into and investigating, when you look at the commercial documents available in the commercial registry, you find that movements of shares, changes in the corporate structure, appointment of new directors, have been made in Tehran, and the document is stamped by the German consulate general in at the embassy in Tehran. So that's how easy it is. Now, again, you know, the fact that a foreign national wants to incorporate a company here or in Dubai, for that matter, you know, it's not evidence of any ill intention. In Dubai, you have a huge expatriate community of Iranians. I think there's about 400,000 Iranians living in Dubai alone. There are, you know, trade connections and ties that go back, you know, a long time. There are some ties with the ruling families of the smaller principalities of the Emirates. If you go back enough, that go, you know, that connect to Iran. Exchange between the two sides of the Gulf has been going on forever. Sometimes it hasn't been friendly, but you know, that doesn't preclude trade. So that's one answer. The second thing is that, you know, Dubai, at the end of the day, or the United Arab Emirates, at the end of the day, are a country of 750,000 citizens. About. They're a country of 6-7 million people, but only 750,000 of them are citizens. You know, Qatar is even less, it's 200,000. And it doesn't matter how much, how many guns and planes and radar system and missile launchers they buy from the United States, when they look across the water, they see a country of 75 plus million people. There is a history of conflict and rivalry alongside the trade and the relations. And they have to hedge their bets, especially now when you're no longer sure that the Americans will come to your rescue or even send you defensive weapons.
But that's an American problem.
Say it again?
That's an American problem.
Well, there's some people in Washington who no longer think so. Unfortunately.
It's a European problem as well.
Yeah, I just returned from Tehran. It was very interesting what you said, and to be honest, at least I couldn't see much effect of the sanctions. Of course, I have no idea about the nuclear industry, but people seem to have quite heavy lives. Police cars are Mercedes-Benz. You can get any shop you want, luxury shop. And so, and I had at least the feeling, I was only there for 50 hours or even less, that they get everything over China, India, Russia, and Turkey. There are 2,000 trucks a day, people told me, coming over the border. So I'm just wondering, I mean, there might be, because of the high technic I'm taking from you, it's difficult on the nuclear side. But I'm just wondering, after this very limited stay there, if any other kind of sanction works. Except, I mean, it's a vibrant city, 15 million people living there.
I can only give you the World Bank and IMF data as by way of example. That they show in the last 2 years negative growth. Iran is now projected to have very modest growth in the year 2014 and a little more in 2015. I can't remember the exact numbers, but we're talking about around 1% growth, a little bit less this year and a little over 1% next year. Iran is a very young country, and about 70% of the population is below 35.
there is a very high rate of official unemployment, which is higher when you actually look at the real situation. A significant number of the population lives now under the poverty line. People who can afford things still are forced to buy Chinese, Indian, and Russian, which I'm sure if you had to choose, you would rather buy something else. The oil industry, as it was mentioned, has taken a tremendous hit. I mean, Iran has had to invest in the last 2 years an enormous amount of resources in creating extra storage capacity. Because if they stop pumping out oil from oil fields will become unusable in the future. So rather than losing the oil they're storing on ships, they have had to pay much higher premiums for insurance because no legitimate insurance, international insurance company will cover their shipping for oil shipments. So again, you're right. You can still buy a Maserati or a Mercedes or a Porsche in Iran, and there are people who buy it. But the overall economic situation has been a lot less pleasant. And most importantly, their foreign currency reserves have been severely depleted as a result of the sanctions regime. So the country has reached a point recently where, again, I don't know what their assessment was, but if you look at some of their statements made by Rouhani after he came into power and other ministers, what you see is that the macroeconomic indicators were very negative. And again, I think that at least in part they were negative as a result of the sanctions regime. And the regime probably, again, I don't know this for a fact, it's a theory, but it is a plausible one, must have concluded that they needed to do whatever it took to relieve the pressure of sanctions. Because there was an existential matter there. And that was always the argument of those like me and my colleague here who advocated sanctions. Our argument was not we want to inflict pain on the Iranians for its own sake. Our argument was we want to put the regime in front of a stark choice, a choice between survival and compromise on the nuclear file. And we want to do that in a coercive but non-violent manner. We don't want a military solution. And we don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons capability. And so sanctions were the obvious default choice, and it seems to me that they have yielded the result. Now, whether a final deal will come out, I don't know. Will people in power at the top suffer from the sanctions? I doubt it. They never did. They didn't in Serbia, they certainly didn't in Iraq, nowhere else. Yes.
In my opinion, they have an advantage because the leadership of Iran wants to exclude the West. They don't want a free society with free exchange with the European Union and with the United States from their personal choice. With all those Ayatollahs, they are the last ones wants to have free exchange between modern Germany.
Well, except that,
I
agree with you that there, certainly within the regime there is a view, very strong view, that fears Western cultural influence. Yeah. But at the same time, it's a nation that has historically thrived on trade and is very capable of trade. It's a nation that has a very high level of highly educated people, a very high number of highly educated people who wants to be part of the modern global economy, perhaps on their own terms, perhaps avoiding the cultural influences that sometimes a globalized economy brings, but they want to be part of it. They want to be able to send their best and brightest to study in Western University. Even if they they don't like Western culture, or they condemn the corruption of Western culture, they still prefer to come and study here or in the United States if they can, rather than going to, you know, other countries that are closer culturally or politically to their system. And by the way, you know, just to give you a sense of how far up this goes, do you know where Mr. Rouhani's daughter is today?
No.
She works for Deutsche Bank as an analyst in London. Do you know where Mr. Zarif's son is today? He works as an analyst for Verizon in New York. Okay? That's how far they're now. These are not, they don't see this as a contradiction. They don't think that by sending their son to study at the best universities in the United States and then working in New York of all places, you know, New York is the, you know, the mother of all corrupted places. They don't see that as a contradiction. They see that as a sign of achievement. They probably laugh behind the back of the United States for being so naive as to let them in. They take the best out of the best and will be put eventually in the fullness of time to the service of the Islamic Republic. So it's not accurate that they want anything to do. They want to have to do with the West on their own terms.
Yeah, I could speak to Mr. Zarif when he was in Germany 2 months ago, and he was absolutely clearly committed to the West, to open to the West, because there have been agreements and have to be developed. And he, by the way, lived for half of his life in America, by the way, Zarif.
No.
And I could speak to many top business people in Iran, and they all, that I can assure you, want some relation to the West and being open more to the West, and at least the elite troops, so to say, are very interested, seem to me personally very interested in this.
But you know, there is a, this is a, I was not witness to this exchange, but it's a story I've heard many times. One of the U.S. hostages at the embassy, after the embassy takeover, spoke a flawless Farsi, and so he was able to communicate with his handlers. And he tells a story which I've heard several times in close circles, where, you know, he was going through a savage beating by his one captor. I don't know what exactly triggered the beating, what he had done. He had insulted him, he had done something he shouldn't have done. Anyway, at the end of the meeting, you know, the captor kind of, you know, helps him put himself together again and apologizes profusely. And then he says, by the way, could you help me get a green card? Okay? So, again, there is no contradiction between being loyal to the revolutionary principles and being antagonistic to the United States and aspiring to hegemony in the Middle East and wanting a nuclear weapons capability or the weapon itself in order to enhance that power. At the same time that you want to trade and exchange, and, you know, if I can send my students to learn mechanical engineering at Caltech as opposed to University of Malaysia, University of Technology, I would rather do that. So there is no contradiction between the two things. And I think that, you know, ultimately, of course, you know, Iran is a much more attractive business partner than pretty much most countries in the region. It has a workforce that is highly qualified. It's a dynamic and interesting society. And by the way, I'm not under the impression that all 75 million Iranians are still so enthusiastic about the revolution and its principles. So, the problem we have with the Islamic Republic is their political ambitions in the region, their way they conduct themselves in the region, and how they aspire to make that conflict even more aggressive by acquiring non-conventional weapons. And that's what we have to ascertain from Mr. Zarif, not whether he wants to trade with the West and open up business and vice versa. Of course they want it. We gotta ascertain whether he's ready to give up that ambition. And I'm not persuaded he has given up.
Before I invite you to some wine and cheese at the foyer, I'm going to take the last question. And after the question, you might say your final words for today.
So you mentioned the fact that one of the networks is operating through Jersey. It's also the fact that Amazon, for example, is also using Jersey in order to make use of the special taxation that is in place there.
Are you from Jersey?
No, I'm not from Jersey. Watch that. But that example might to me how difficult it is to fight the operations of these networks. So I was wondering how likely is it that the P5 states can actually do something against these networks, since they have to hurt themselves or companies that are from their countries. These networks are using the same ways that other multinational companies like Amazon, like Google, like what are also using in Switzerland and Jersey.
Yeah, well, except that, when Google chooses Ireland as a place to incorporate because it has the lowest corporate tax in the Western world, it does so openly and transparently. It says, we can do it and we will do it. When the Iranian regime identifies Jersey Island or Labuan in Malaysia as a place to run companies, it doesn't say, we have chosen to do our banking in Malaysia because it's a friendly environment, and so it puts it on its website and opens up BankNet in Malaysia. They conceal their activities. So that's the difference. This is not a question of just tax avoidance or reducing your corporate costs by shopping around for the best jurisdiction. It's something more akin to what the mafia does, namely finding places where you can both conduct yourself financially in happy ways and without being detected. Now, as you know, you drew, I think, a very accurate comparison or analogy. In times of recession, governments become more acutely aware of the need to fight tax evasion. And so, they go after banking secrecy, they go after tax havens, they go after all these things. Paradoxically, all of these measures, which are not targeted at the government of Iran and its activities abroad, but they're targeted at Mr. John Smith, who has put his money in Liechtenstein, and Mrs. Joanna Smith, who's put her money in the Cayman Islands, are helping make it easier to discover what governments, and Iran, by the way, is not the only government that uses these tax havens to avoid being detected, are making it easier to find them. 20, 30 years ago, and this is another interesting point I discovered in my research, that the truth is that Iran has not reinvented the wheel. They're taking practices they had already developed in the 1980s when they were trying to avoid the arms embargo during the Iran-Iraq War. And they just upgraded everything to the 21st century technology and environment. One of the things that this 21st century technology environment has created is that whereas in the 1980s, if you wanted to find one of these companies, you somehow had to have a tip from somebody. And you had to, you had to take a plane and fly to a far off place. And then you had to go and snoop around and knock on doors. It would be very difficult. So even if you were a journalist with the full funding of a big publication, or you were a government official and you had, if you were James Bond and you proverbially flew to the Bahamas all the time to discover nasty people, it would be very difficult to find things. Today, even the Panama Commercial Registry is online. The Jersey Commercial Registry is online. So the challenge for the Iranians to hide and not to be detected is different. What they do is they hide in plain sight. So
and
for
what?
They hide in plain sight. So you know, because as opposed to the 1980s was when there was relatively little information available. Today there's too much information. So you know, there's somebody I'm interested in now who seems to have taken over another financial institution on behalf of the Iranian regime. And he has established a company named 7H. Now try and find that company, if you don't know where it is incorporated, by Googling 7H. You will have to go through 23 million entries before you might be lucky enough to find something online. And that's what they do. So, you know, they're using names of known brands to create companies, and they add a little word, or they misspell it, or and instead of finding what you're looking for, you find something else altogether. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of stuff is online today, which didn't exist back then. And the last point is that because they don't rely on trained agents, but you know, just ordinary people who are willing to help for a variety of reasons. Turns out that these people suffer from the same disease that we all suffer from in our digital age of Facebook and Google, which is narcissism. And so what they do is they put too much information out on the internet. So the company may not have a website, and you may not be able to find it anywhere. But the IT person or the commercial director of that company has a LinkedIn profile 3 pages long that tells you everything you need.